Well, we've been looking at the eighth chapter of the 1689 Confession, which is the chapter on Christ the Mediator. And we ended that by speaking concerning the order the importance of Christ's offices of prophet, priest, and king. As a prophet, he teaches us because we are ignorant and need that. But not only does he teach us, but he gives us learning and understanding. Second of all, is his office of priest as he's prepared the sacrifice of himself and offered his sacrifice. And then the third office is the office, of king, whereby he subdues us. We're most willing to serve our king. And he's powerful, and not to serve him is a very dangerous thing. But our desire is to serve him. And so in these offices, the number and order of them, extremely important for us to know that he must reveal himself, we must be forgiven, and he must lead us. Which leads straight into the next subject, and that is the subject of free will. Chapter 9 of the 1689 Confession is given to the whole subject of free will. Now, it is probably one of the most misunderstood subjects in all the Bible. It is misunderstood not only by the Arminian who talks about free will as if man's will is determinative, or as if God is waiting to see what men will do, or and the worst kind of understanding of that is that God is limited by the will of man and is really waiting, as it were, for man's permission to do what he desires to do. And then on the other extreme of that is a misunderstanding of people that would say that men and their will has nothing to do with anything, that they are not able to make any choice whatsoever, that they are basically puppets or robots, that God does everything, they do nothing. So both extremes are unbiblical. And so it's very important that we understand and know that we listen to what our forefathers, those who were steeped in Reformed faith, and Reformed faith, you know, we must understand that's the Reformation, that's the reclaiming of faith, the reclaiming of biblical truth in the Reformation, that truth that had been diminished and that truth that had been altered by 1,000 years of medieval Roman Catholicism from roughly the time of Augustine. And Augustine and Luther would indeed be on the same theological page. In fact, it's very interesting that Luther was an Augustine monk. And so he read Augustine, or as we would call him maybe Augustine. He read him, he knew him, and ultimately this came together for Luther, even as the Spirit led him. And so these people, these Reformed people, beginning with Luther and then, of course, many, many other Reformers, John Calvin, and then after Calvin, the Puritans, and then 100 years roughly, and then after the Puritans, great theologians, and then of course the Baptists in England rose up out of the Reform movement to reform not only soteriology, how we get saved, but Baptists reformed ecclesiology. What does the Bible teach about how the church should be put together and how the church should function? And so Reformation is really about ecclesiology. It's really about taking all of the Roman Catholic perversions of ritual out, those things that were formed by the faults of men and put into Christianity over the years by misunderstanding and basically just doing what they thought they could get away with often. And so the Reformation is about the church. It's about doing church. It's about how do we approach God and how God has taught us to do that. Well, so here's the mediator. Here is salvation coming to man. How can man receive it? How can man deal with this salvation? So the first paragraph of the chapter 9 on free will talks about natural liberty and power of choice. Now, Deuteronomy 30:19 says, I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death. And of course, here's Moses speaking the word of the Lord to the people of Israel. Here's toward the end of the second law, Deuteronomy. And I've laid before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live. So here's the Lord saying to his people, here's the choice. And indeed, that is a message that we say to the world. We say to them, here is the choice. Here is God. Will you live for God or will you live for self? Will you bring life unto yourself or death? Will you live in the blessings of the Lord or will you live in the curse of the Lord? So here it is. And not only is it about you, choose life. Because if you choose life, it will have an effect not only upon you, but upon those that come after you. And in fact, the Old Testament, I should say, is filled with these kind of things. For example, the commandment that we shouldn't make any graven image of any likeness of anything in heavens above and the earth beneath, the water under the earth. Because then he says, because I'm a jealous God. And I will visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, but will show mercy unto the thousands who love me and keep my commandment. You'll notice that the grace of God is always exponentially greater than the judgment of God. Or the judgment, the sin, will go to two or three generations. But what are two or three generations when you begin to talk about thousands of generations? Less than a tenth of a percent. Grace is abundant, exponentially abundant. So here it is. Well, paragraph 1 says, God hath endued the will of man with that natural liberty. So natural liberty means that which comes with nature. So when God created man, he created man with a liberty. There's no strings attached to him. There are no, obviously, organic strings. Or what we would call, you know, concrete or literal strings. But there are no metaphysical strings either. There's no unseen strings. God created man. He endued him, that is, he put in him naturally the idea of liberty. So he's free. He's not put in any kind of bind or locked into any kind of course. And he also endued man with power, or with that power of acting upon choice. So our whole life is filled with choice. Every moment of every day, it's filled with choice. In fact, it is so full of choice that often we don't even notice. We don't even feel that there is a choice. It's not something that we even contemplate. It's just something we do, this choice. And that it is neither forced, so there's not any kind of power on our will or affecting our liberty or our power of acting upon choice. There's no force. There's no one, you know, we read the phrase concerning the providence of God or the decrees of God, no violence to the will of the creature. And second of all, nor by any necessity of nature determined to do good or evil. So when God created Adam, there was nothing in his nature, that is no program in his nature. He didn't program him to good, nor did he program him to evil. Here it is. Now, these things are not, when we go to these passages of scripture, the Bible's really not about man. It's not about anything to do with man. It's just like when we talk about at the end of our life and when we're buried. What about heaven and how do we get there? And what's all, well, the Bible just kind of incidentally talks about that as it incidentally, or as it talks about Christ, it just incidentally talks about how that relates to us. He doesn't give us a full discourse of any of these things. In the same way with this. So we just get the flavor of it. So Matthew 17:12 says, "But I say unto you," Jesus speaking, "that Elias is come already." So there's this prophecy that Elijah would come. And of course that was John the Baptist. And Jesus said, "Elias has come already. And they knew him not, but have done unto him whatsoever they," in the King James word, "listed," which is the word, the translation of the word, whatever they wished or willed to do. Likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer them. So they're going to, there was no predetermination about how they would treat John the Baptist or Elijah. They found it in their own heart how they would treat him and how they would treat Christ. And then James 1:14 says, "But every man is tempted." So when you're tempted, you know, he says before this, when you're tempted, don't say, "I'm tempted of God. God has tempted me here." No. "But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed." Now again, this is very hard for us to understand because we are blinded to a lot of this. We don't really, it's much beyond reason and rationality. And that's why the rationalists miss it. Because they presuppose that everything can be understood through their own reasoning, as if their reasoning has not been affected by sin, but it has been. See, our reasoning is sinful reason. It's not even the reasoning that Adam could do. And yet there's Adam, when Adam had perfect reasoning. And he was not endued with any kind of, let me put it positively. He was endued with natural liberty and power of acting upon choice, but it wasn't ever forced, and there was no program, no necessity of his nature that told him to do what was right or what was wrong. It was purely a choice. And of course, what's interesting about that is when Adam had a pure choice, he chose sin. How much more will we choose sin, we who are now under the bondage of sin, and that sin is now binding our will? You see, that is the false presupposition that leads so many people to unbelief, so many people to a misunderstanding of God and a rejection of God. So that he indeed thinks that his will is free, or that his nature is unencumbered by sin, but it's not. I mean, we're not on God's side. We are contrary to God. We're on the other side. Now the devil may tempt us and blind us, and people may talk us into the idea that we love God. But the Bible is very clear. If you don't keep his commandments, and if you say you love God and keep not his commandments, you're a liar. And you do not the truth. But you're speaking a lie, and you're living a lie. The second paragraph says, man in his state of innocency. Now this is when Adam and Eve, before they sinned, man in his state of innocency had freedom and power to will and to do that which was good and well-pleasing to God. Again, Ecclesiastes 7:29 says, lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright. But they, that means man or men, have sought out many inventions. But though Adam had this freedom and power to will and to do that which was good and well-pleasing, this will was unstable. Meaning, he wasn't fixed in that. He might fall from it. And he did. And some theologians believe that he fell the first day. The first day that Eve was there. He made Adam and Eve, and there they were, and first day. Well, I don't know. But surely one day. We read in Genesis 3:6, when the woman saw that the tree was good after being tempted by the serpent, good for food, it was pleasant to the eyes, tree to be desired to make one wise. She was the wisest then as she would ever be. She is the wisest woman then as any woman would ever be. And in her wisdom, she sought more wisdom. And in sinfully seeking more wisdom, she lost even the wisdom she had. So she took the fruit and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her. Very important, that little phrase, with her. He was with her. Should have protected her, didn't. In fact, I think he used her. He didn't love her. He didn't love her more as much as he loved himself. And when she didn't die, he ate. Paragraph 3 says, and by this, or by his fall into a state of sin, hath wholly lost all ability of will. So he has no ability of will to any spiritual good. Now that doesn't mean he couldn't choose. It doesn't mean that he couldn't choose between alternatives. He never lost that. Now, he did lose the the holiness and the innocency that would inform his choice. But he didn't lose any ability to choose. I mean, he could eat an apple or an orange, I guess, if there were oranges in the garden. Or he could eat or not eat, or he could go or not go, or he could do or not do. But he lost the ability of will to any spiritual good accompanying salvation. And that's the whole point. So what did Adam lose? What did Adam have that we no longer have because of his sin? The ability to will, meaning to desire, or to choose any spiritual good accompanying salvation. We're totally and contrarily, maybe I should say, against that. We do not, cannot will any spiritual good that either would, number one, save us, or number two, prepare us unto salvation. So as a natural man, being altogether averse from that good, so we despise. I mean, it is like, you know, whatever, rotten meat to us, you know, or broccoli to us, or to me maybe. I mean, I loathe it. I detest it. It makes me gag when I think about it. I mean, it would just think about the most hideous thing that you could consider that you would be in or you would do. And it would be nauseating to you to even consider. Well, that's what spiritual good accompanying salvation is to us. It is that which is repugnant. And we see it over and over again. Why are the LGBT plus or whatever we're calling them now, why do they despise the word? Because it's repugnant to them. And yet they run after any kind of perversion. And they love it. Despise good, despise God, despise that which would bring life and hope and peace and joy, and run after that which brings destruction and death and sadness and sorrow, and ultimately, at the end of the thing, there you will be in your own putridity. And have lost everything, including the hope of forgiveness. And every time they run for that. So he's altogether averse from good. And he's dead in sin. Not able, by his own strength, to convert himself or to prepare himself thereunto. That's why it's absolute absurdity that any preacher would preach to a person that he needs to straighten up, get right, and then God will love him. Number one, that's just not true, because you can't earn the merit of God. But number two, who's going to do that? I mean, if he's adverse to good, why would he convert himself? In fact, you see it. You see the animosity and the anger. You see the animosity and anger of people when we start talking about conversion. I mean, have you heard, you know, the discussion about, you know, those of us who would preach and teach people who are beset by homosexual sin, that we would say you don't have to live that way. You could be converted, conversion therapy. And I don't believe in conversion therapy in the sense that you can run somebody through a counseling office and change his heart from being one who lusts after men in a perverted way that you could just kind of talk him out of it. No, I don't believe in that. I don't think that that kind of quote unquote conversion therapy would be helpful, but they despise even the idea of it. And they surely despise if you come to them and say to them, you must stop that activity. Well, I love it. I want it. I desire it. I run after it. I can't help myself, but do it. Yeah, I know that because your will is altogether averse. As a natural man, because you have lost all ability to will any good accompanying salvation, you are averse to this goodness that I'm holding before you now. Not because I hate you, but because I love you. Not because that I want you to live in sadness and sorrow, but because I want you to live in joy and hope and peace with God and with self. Because you know these people that seek, you know these people that in homosexual relationships and or in some kind of transgender thing, you know suicide rate is much higher in those people than, and of course they say, well, it's because they're oppressed. No, it's not because they're oppressed from the outside. It's because they are oppressed from the inside, and ultimately they loathe themselves. But yet if you tell them that they are sinners, then they will be vindictive towards you and hateful, and they will not believe it, and they will accuse you of being hateful. And in reality, we are trying to be loving to them. He's not able by his own strength to convert himself or to prepare himself. If you'll just come a little bit, then God will do the rest. No. That's wrong. Not only is that wrong for preachers to say, because I mean it's just factually incorrect, but it's damnable. It's just damnable. You take away any hope for their salvation when you start telling them that they have to do something. For example, Romans 5:6 says, for when we were without strength, we didn't have any strength. We were absolutely strengthless. In due time, Christ died for the ungodly. Or Romans 8:7, because the carnal mind is enmity against God. Your mind naturally wars against God. Why should we be surprised when we see this from infidels, when we see this from people that don't believe? Why should we at all be surprised when they war and fight against God? Because we know even our own heart. We remember the days when we fought against God, when we hated God, when we resented God telling us what to do. Or when we thought we could hide from God and do the things that we desired to do. And as if God would never notice or God would be somehow obligated to look over. You see, the carnal, that is the fleshly mind, when the flesh is in the mind, and the flesh stays in the members, that's totally a total different issue there. That's the spiritual war. But when the carnality and the flesh gets in the mind, it's enmity against God. For it is not subject to the law of God. That is, that's the open rebellion. It's not subject to the law of God. We will not have this man to rule over us. That's what they said about Christ. So they crucified him. Why? Because he dared to rule over us with this holy talk. We will not have this man. You see, they're not subject to the law of God. They despise the law of God. They try to relegate it to what it is not, to the laws of men or to changing mores of men's taste. And therefore, it's okay, you see, because it's just the ancient mind that was uninformed. It's the ancient mind that is not progressive. It's the ancient mind that is bigoted and prejudiced against us. We will not submit to it. But you see, it's much worse than that. For it is not subject to the law of God. Neither indeed can be. This will always be the reaction. It is the natural reaction of men to God. And when you step out to represent God in the office of the prophet, when you stand to represent God to the people and call them from their sin, their hatred of God is unleashed on you. Now, I would just, and I know it's pretty often the talk, not only the words, but the attitudes is pretty rough. But if you just want to see a modern day example of Romans 8, 7, if you want to just go and look up Doug Wilson's talk or questions and answer to whatever at the University of Indiana, and just watch the people rail on him with profanity and mockery and hatefulness. Even though he's trying his best to be loving and kind and gentle with them. And basically, at the end of the thing, is leading them to Christ to say, listen, you don't have to live this way. And their hateful, visceral hatefulness. And we're going to see it over and over again. I mean, you see it already, don't you? I mean, if you watch any news, or just, I'll give you some homework. Just go home and watch Tucker Carlson. I don't know. If you didn't tape it, you won't get to watch him, but just watch what he's talking about and the people that despise him and what he brings. That's a picture of it. There it is. Maybe you don't even have to go that far. Just go, just witness to the next verse and watch that reaction. I mean, we're in the Bible Belt, Laurel, Mississippi.